With that, I think we can begin with our first session today on disclosures, goodwill, and impairment. And I hand over to the team, probably you,
yes.
Craig.
Thank you. Thank you, Bertrand. And hello to the GPF members. So in this session, we're going to ask you about some specific topics in relation to the board's goodwill and impairment project. As a reminder, the board published a discussion paper last year called Business Combinations, Disclosures, Goodwill and Impairment. And this year, the board has been discussing the feedback on that discussion paper, and it has begun to make some tentative decisions as part of its reconsideration of those preliminary views. So the preliminary views included trying to improve disclosures about business combinations, considering the accounting for goodwill, and some other topics about the accounting for business combinations. In September this year, the board decided to prioritise analysing feedback on two particular topics. So first of all, the disclosures about business combinations, and secondly, some specific aspects of the debate as to whether to retain the impairment-only model for accounting for goodwill or whether to reintroduce amortisation. So we have three questions that we hope to ask you today, and I'm going to introduce the first of those three questions that's about the disclosures on business combinations. Once we've discussed that topic, we'll hand over to my colleague Tim here, who's going to talk about the remaining two questions, being about the feasibility of estimating a useful life of goodwill and any potential effects of reintroducing amortisation. So on the first topic then, the board's preliminary view to improve the information entities provide about the subsequent performance of goodwill, it uses the concept of an entity's chief operating decision maker to identify the business combinations that an entity would need to provide information about. So applying the board's preliminary view, an entity would need to disclose the information that a CODM is monitoring to assess whether a business combination has met CODM's objectives for that particular acquisition. And the board identified a number of potential benefits of using the CODM in this way, including that it might try to strike a balance between the benefits and the costs of entities providing that information. And that's because the board expected that an entity's CODM would be looking at the most important information about the most important acquisitions. However, some respondents to the discussion paper raised concerns that using the CODM in this way might result in users missing out on material information about business combinations. And so the questions on this particular topic we have for GPF members are on slide 11. And we're seeking your input as to whether there's a difference between the business combinations that your CODM reviews and the business combinations for which you provide information applying the existing disclosure requirements in IFRS 3 today. If there is a difference, we'd ask you to explain what that difference is and whether that difference exists at the time of the acquisition and whether that difference exists in the subsequent monitoring of those business combinations. And so I'll hand over to the GPF members to discuss.
So I suggest that you volunteer in the chat room for those who would like to speak. And of course, I have some board members in the boardroom or attending remotely. Do not hesitate to intervene should you want to ask a question or make a comment. So Jan, please.
Okay, and just to add that dealing specifically with this topic, I think from our side, two aspects we do appreciate. I think the CODM is a nice try and make the thing sort of light and manageable. And I think regardless of whether it's operational, I think we do appreciate the intention to try and do so. I'd rather fear this one's not going to deliver what you would like to see, because, for example, the proposals as currently outlined at Roche, we will disclose precisely nothing on this particular area. This is because, firstly, we don't track the performance of a business combination in the way that the proposal imagines. We track our business, of course, but when there's a BizCom, we will incorporate that in our main business plans, and we will sort of go forward on a we basis, and we don't sort of chase the BizCom in isolation. I can imagine other people, if there's a really, really big BizCom that's sort of like some mega merger, there may well be some separate tracking, but we don't have any experience of that. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, in terms of IFRS 8, our chief operating decision maker is our corporate executive committee. And we have two divisions. So to the extent any business combinations, M&A activity or anything else is reviewed, it will be done at the divisional level. So it actually wouldn't be shown necessarily at the CEC level. So actually, even if we did have this stuff, we wouldn't show it anyway. So I think the proposal, it's a nice try, but I think you might be, it will work for some people and it will not work in other cases. And that will rather depend on the structure of the company in terms of what segments they have for IFRS 8 and how they have determined their CODM at IFRS 8. So I think you might want to rethink it. But it's the intention is good.
Can I ask a clarification, Jan, please, on what you said at the end on the information looked at by what you determine being the body, you determine being the CODM per IFRS 8. Why did you say that even if the information would be available, you wouldn't disclose it? Could you eventually repeat that and elaborate a bit more on these, please?
Well, we might voluntarily disclose. I'm not saying we wouldn't disclose it, but the standard as written wouldn't require us to disclose it because, firstly, it doesn't exist in the form narrowly isolating the performance of a BizCom. It's not tracked in isolation. We don't do that. I think some people do. A lot of people don't. And secondly, to the extent any performance is discussed, it will be discussed at the divisional level, so it wouldn't actually be at the corporate executive committee level. Now, having said all of that, that's not to say we wouldn't choose to disclose something voluntarily in good spirit, the standard, but I think what you're rather getting at is there's a concern that companies aren't being required to disclose stuff, and I think if you're thinking this is going to catch that, I think you might be disappointed. I think that's rather my point. The good corporate citizens will go along with the spirit of the law, but the letter of the law here has quite a big hole in it, in my view.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification, Jan. Richard, please. Oh, sorry, Johan first. Johan first. Sorry about it. Johan?
I'm obviously on mute, sorry.
Yes.
To a large extent, I will agree to what Ian just said. I think the main problem, in addition to maybe the CODM question, is exactly as you put it, is that a normal business combination, if it's not very large, so it constitutes a total new business area or something, I think will not be followed up in that way that it's sort of described in this proposal, because it will be incorporated in a current business area, in the current normal business, and then that's what will be followed up. And then if there is an ambition to have, well, a certain cost reduction recurring due to business combination or synergies, or if it's a whatever quantitative criteria put up, it's very hard to say, okay, now we had this result the next year, exactly how much of that is due to the business combination and due to other things. It's complex because it's normally not followed up explicitly just based on the business combination. So I think maybe I'm repeating a little bit what Ian said, but I think that's my main concern as well, that it will be very difficult because it's not the way we typically follow this up. It's more that of course we have a view on what synergies or whatever it would lead to, but it will rather be followed up as a part of the larger part of the company or the group where the business combination is made. So I agree to that. That is my main concern, actually. It will be a little bit artificial and required information that will be produced for this single purpose rather than actually normally being done this way.
Tom, our board member has a question probably for you or a comment.
Yeah, I have a question. And we thought about this when we
we created the discussion paper, the whole question of integration, and I wouldn't mind getting a bit of elaboration. Fundamentally, we know that entities often will acquire another entity with the intention of incorporating it in existing divisions or forming a new division or even splitting it in two and putting it in divisions. But our presumption was that when you did that, you had some idea about what this new division or, you know, when you put it in the division, you would have some idea of the importance of it to that division and what the performance would be in that division. And we were fairly clear, we thought, that you could report on your expectations for the existing division that you're going to put it in. So what would it, you know, what would the profit expectations be for the division with the new entity plugged into it? And, you know, how would it do? And I would have thought that you would have had some targets like that. And we'd never ask you to isolate. We ask you just to declare what you're going to do with it and then report on what you think is the reasonable thing that you can report on. And if I could get a bit of elaboration there, because that was something that we really tried hard to address so that it would make it possible to provide some information in cases where there is integration.
If I may, I hear you, and I think maybe I have maybe then to some extent misinterpreted the proposal, because of course I think if it's, at least if it's a material acquisition, normally I think we would probably disclose things about that, and the question for me is rather how, as long as we have enough, let's say, freedom, what we choose to disclose based on the way we see the actual acquisition, then I think it's useful, and that what we would probably do anyway. But I think the definitions then of what is needed from a quantitative perspective, that disclosures will be quite important. But yes, I agree, of course, on that. So maybe I have misread this a little bit in that case, perhaps. But I think still it can be difficult in some extent to quantify subsequent effects of the acquisition when it's incorporated in or integrated in the larger part of the operations.
Jan, you're on mute, Jan.
Yeah, how can I think it can depend on the acquisition, because typically if you've got an acquisition without a certain revenue stream and a certain cost stream, what the so-called synergies are often a saving of general administration costs like HR, finance, et cetera, et cetera. So you only really see that in the context of the much wider business. It's difficult to isolate how much of that is actually due to the transaction. And believe me, we've tried it. We did try it once and we switched it off because it was just not delivering anything meaningful. So what we track going forward is we will track the sort of the operation as is, or the division or the part of the business in the new world, so to speak, and we won't isolate within that what the new world would have been if we hadn't done the transaction, because it's extremely difficult to do that, and it's actually, we feel, counterproductive, because it ends up with an us and them attitude, whereas if you've paid and acquired a new business, you actually want to integrate everybody and want to be all part of the same new team, so you really don't want to be doing this kind of, if you're not careful, it can develop into an internal kind of sort of finger-pointing exercise. If these guys haven't delivered on this, we rather want to move forward together. I think it is different if you've done a really, really big one, then there would be something. But for the sort of medium and small-sized ones, it's not really possible to segregate it.
Richard?
Yeah, thank you. Two types of business combinations, those that are then subsequently run more or less independently, and they're never fully independent. There's always some synergies that spill over into different CGUs or something like that. So those we track, and to answer your question, chief operating decision maker would track all the material ones and then some, so that I don't think there's any risk that there would be a business combination that was being standalone that the CODM did not review being immaterial. So I don't think that first question is an issue. The other type of business combination is one that gets integrated pretty quickly. And those are monitored, but they're monitored with different metrics. So you can't use an operating profit if they're integrated completely because you've got already shared allocated costs, you've got shared management fees, etc. So we track those, but not with a different set of metrics. It may just be sales, volume, gross profit. And there may be quantifiable synergies that are tracked, but often the synergies are not specifically tracked if they're expected to show up in a different CGU or something like that. But the two types of treatment are monitored differently. Would be my main point. So that the integrated ones are monitored, but with a different set of metrics, typically.
Thank you, Richard. Aki?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. My view is that post-merger integration activity makes tracking very difficult in a certain industry, like pharmaceutical. So I think the most easiest way to track is like, you know, line of service, line of product, at least revenue, gross profit, operating profit per service, per product. That could be at least easily tracked. Even though, yeah, of course, those are the basis for impairment testing as well. So I think line of service, line of product, that is the least minimum possible idea, in my view. Thank you.
Thank you, Aki. Srinath, I hope I pronounce your first name well.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Enough. We can hear you. Perfect.
Yeah, thank you. So I have one comment to make here when it comes to a business which is newly acquired, and if it gets integrated with the other business unit on day one, and the management intention is to combine those as an independent segment, and they expect not to keep track of individual businesses which were integrated. For example, we had one business in Europe, an asset-light model wherein we operate vessels. So we acquired another company in Singapore, yet another company based out of India and Middle East. So all these assets are put together in one basket, and we have set up as one legal entity which holds all these assets. There is a CEO for that entity. When we talk about all these tracking of integration benefits or synergies, so the management is very clear that we don't want to track individually these business units. It is taken as a whole. And from day one, once these are acquired, we don't want to keep track of that because we are interchanging the assets, we are interchanging the routes, we are placing the asset where we can make more money. So the identity of past acquisition is lost from day one. So in that case, it would be really difficult to disclose something meaningful which can be tracked in future. I'm not sure if anybody else has similar experience.
I think that is a comment we are hearing from many of those that have already expressed themselves. Jan made a comment in the chat. May I read it, Jan? Because I think it's a fair comment to and a fair question to ask the team. If the M&A deal leads to a new segment, of course the existing IFRS 8 disclosure should be sufficient. Shouldn't it? So why, in a nutshell, why requesting then additional disclosures?
I think there's the difference between the information at the time of acquisition and subsequently. So I think if it's segment information subsequently, then probably there's going to be a duplication. And so you maybe wouldn't provide that. But one of the things that the board's preliminary view requires is at the time of acquisition, to disclose what those metrics are and the target for those metrics. And so I don't think you would have that information at the time of acquisition about what you're expecting that segment to do in future is the main difference I would expect, which hopefully...
Does it answer your question, your comment, Jan, or do you want to jump in following Craig?
I think one general point for folks to consider, when you're doing an acquisition, if you're in a hostile acquisition scenario, actually as the acquiring company, you don't know that much. So a lot of what you're doing is kind of sort of aspirational and guesswork stuff that you hope this will come. And then once you've acquired the entity, then you start to figure it out. And even if it's a friendly deal, often these work and are very, very restricted inside a list. So you have certain high-level estimates, but it's not really that concretely analyzed it in the way that you think. I didn't truly understand the answer because, I mean, our biggest acquisition we did was like 20 years ago, and you can still see how it's doing because it's still a segment in our IFRS 8 disclosure. We've got the sort of the sales segment profit, et cetera, plus commentary in the MD&A. I think, it's always a challenge, you know, which ones do you want to capture and which ones not? But you obviously don't want to capture every little single tiny one, but you want to somehow capture the big ones, and it's a question how to do that.
Stefan?
Yes, I have actually a little bit the same comment or a long comment along the same line. When I report an acquisition as a separate segment, I mean, then I'm super transparent about that acquisition. Why should I then disclose anything additionally in IFRS 8 when I have anyway already, when I'm disclosing all the numbers which are present and there? Then when it comes to the question before, okay, you integrate an entity. When you integrate an entity and you're not tracking the acquisition anymore separately, I mean, you still guide the market to what are you going to expect as a performance from this segment in the future. So by that, actually, you have an automatic kind of disclosure around how are you from an overall perspective tracking against your business plan and the communication you have done to the market before? The underlying problem, so which you're not going to resolve, you might be performing better, for example, than what you have laid out in your plan in this specific segment, but that overperformance comes from another area than what you anticipated in the acquisition. But I mean, you know, to distinguish between those different parameters becomes a very kind of arbitrary call. And then a little bit on the Codem comment, I think the chief operating decision makers, he follows up on acquisitions from different angles, depending on what was the purpose of the acquisition. He might actually be interested in something rather immaterial and follow up on that one because he thinks that is something which is relevant for the company in 5-6 years' time because it's a new technology, it's a new market which you want to explore and so on and so forth. You might end up with very mixed kind of acquisitions being reported if you focus too much on the chief operating decision makers. I mean, you know, materiality might be different on the type of acquisition and what you expect from the acquisition in the future. Is it just a synergy play versus kind of this is an investment in a new market where you might only see something in 5 years' time?
Thank you, Stefan. Xiaofeng?
Okay. I'll say something. I think about the scoping with respect to providing disclosure on the most significant transactions that are reviewed by the CODM, I think it's a sensible approach. You know, based my experience, that's only very, very significant should be reviewed by the top management. And along that time, some respondents mentioned using quantitative like percentage of revenue or market cap to determine what to disclose. So my view is that gets reviewed by the CODM would not only be determined based on the size, but a number of different qualitative factors. These factors would include whether the acquisition falls in within the strategic focus of the company, or the establishment of a completely new line of business, even very smaller in size at the time of the acquisition. This should also warrant disclosure. Like in China now, everyone, you know, every enterprise is transforming towards to their 30-60 objectives. Like Sinopec ourselves, we are actively looking into potential acquisition that are the that are in the renewable energy sector. Such acquisitions may be smaller in size, but fall under our overall strategy directions. Therefore, they could be subject to disclosure. Of course, this acquisition may also be reviewed by our top management. So my point is, in the factors used to determine what would be to be disclosed, could consider both quantitative and qualitative factors. So this is my review, my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Zeng. Stefan? You had a follow-up comment on Jan's previous comment.
Yes, thank you. So I think one of the issues is not around whether the CODM reviews anything, but it's around what they review. And Ian did touch on that. And I think the underlying assumption here is that the CODM will be reviewing in the context of whatever targets and assumptions were placed on the business at the time of acquisition. And quite often that isn't the case, particularly when businesses are integrated into other businesses. It just becomes a review of the new segment. So that's one element. But the other is the underlying assumption here is that the valuation is based on a discounted cash flow basis. And that's just one valuation technique. And my concern around these disclosures is that if that isn't the key driver in the valuation for the business case for the acquisition itself, then stage one is to create a discounted cash flow that magically agrees to the amount that was paid. And then secondly, we're then looking at setting targets against that discounted cash flow. And my concern here is that we can become quite removed from business reality quite quickly. And at the same time, we're asking for lots of detailed information, potentially, which then just it is a struggle to comply with, and also to keep our own integrity in, are we really representing what the board or decision maker had in mind when they were making this acquisition? Thank you.
I see no further comment in this regard. Is it fair to say that from what I've heard this morning, the answers that were provided to you would be, it depends?
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Which, honestly, which does not surprise me that much. Do you want to eventually, do you have any further questions in relation to that? Do you need any further clarification? Do you want to react on what you heard?
No, I mean, I don't think I have any other further questions as such. But I think you kind of summed it up already in terms of, yeah, there's certainly, it depends is the answer. In some cases, we heard the CODM is maybe not looking at this and like at the divisional level. In other cases, UDM is looking at all material items and more, possibly. And there's a bit of a question as to whether they're maybe looking at things that are qualitatively material as well, or perhaps small in size.
And probably the tracking post-acquisition, when the newly acquired business is effectively integrated within an existing, an already existing operation. I think we heard that also quite a few times this morning. Okay. Rika has a question, comment, please, Rika.
I just want to add one thing to what Craig and Bertrand wrap up about this discussion. I mean, I thought we might have some room or possibility to improve the segment information in connection with acquired businesses. I really think, when considering the existing practice of segment information within the financial statement as well as the management commentary, I think, some companies voluntarily disclose specific information of the acquired business in connection with segment information. But when we look at our standard, there is no kind of the requirement about the company to explain the connection between the acquired business and how they determine the segment and how they change and what the impact actually happened in the subsequent period. So maybe that kind of thing might be a natural interaction for the management to consider, and also maybe the communication with the investors. So thank you very much for input.
Thanks, Bertrand. I would like to ask a question about the disclosures when the acquisition is integrated. So in our proposals, we've said that if the acquisition is integrated, then give us some sort of disclosures around the combined unit. So this is in reference to what Tom was asking earlier. And I'm still not clear if that's viewed by members of the committee as a viable approach, or do they see shortcomings in that approach like they've shared other shortcomings today?
And
sorry, just to bolt on to that question as well, it's just a question of whether then if entity provide information on an integrated basis, would the CODM not be reviewing that integrated information? I understand they might not review information about standalone business acquisition because they're integrated, but at least our initial thinking was that they would be reviewing the integrated information. So again, just to bolt on to Anne's question, is to see whether A, that would be viable, and B, would the CODM not be looking at that? And if not, would there be another level of management that would be?
From what I've heard this morning, based on my prior experience as a preparer, but then I will, of course, leave the floor to the GPF members. What was said this morning is effectively there is a form of tracking potentially prior to the acquisition, and it's not, Jan mentioned, hostile acquisition, in which case maybe you don't have necessarily all the information you could have when it's a more agreed upon acquisition, let's put it that way. And then there's the question of the subsequent tracking. The disclosures were about the performance of the acquisition. And I think what I've heard this morning from GPF members is that in many cases, it is difficult to track the performance of the acquisition. And do not, it's what I've understood. Please do not hesitate to correct me, GPF members, if I summarize your views improperly. Jan?
No, you did it nicely, I think. Sorry. Do you want to go first?
Yes, absolutely. You have heard it right. If I understand the whole philosophy here, we have an impairment model. Earlier, there was amortization model. So we switched to impairment model, which says that once you recognize goodwill, you carry out annual tests for impairment, and if there are for in general for any intangible assets with indefinite life, you follow the same principle. Annual impairment test should take care of any impairment which exists at the year-end reporting. But in this case, what, if I understand clearly the background or the objective of this whole exercise, is since the impairments are not rigorously being monitored or accounted for, you are trying to introduce a disclosure mechanism by which you want managements to commit how goodwill is going to be recovered over a period of time. That is what your disclosure is aimed at. So how am I going to recover this? Am I going to do this in next 5 years and 10 years, either through synergies or employees, etc.? And then you are trying to track it, and you are trying to tie the management to their own objective, so that if it is not achieved later, you want to compare and then make them forced impairment of goodwill. Is that what is the intention?
Please. So I, yeah, in terms of the link with the impairment test itself, I guess there obviously was some concern in the PIR of IFRS 3 about the impairment test being less effective and perhaps impairments being recognised later than something they should be. And the disclosures are part of the way I think the board has trying to address that in terms of actually what users have told us they're trying to use the impairment test information for is really to try and work out whether this acquisition has been a success or not. And so these disclosures are kind of attempt to more directly answer that user question rather than to focus on the impairment test itself.
So if that is the case, if a business is fully integrated and if we have a larger basket, then it would be very difficult to track the individual goodwill of the acquisition versus the overall synergies for the entire basket wherein you put all the eggs together. So I don't know how that is going to work. It's just a question. You may not have the answer, but I just wanted to highlight that this is one of the difficulty we may have.
Tom, you want to jump in?
Well, softly, cautiously tread into the discussion. I think what the impairment, one impairment is, if you think of a distribution, so you go and you do an acquisition and you have expectations for success and you have this range of outcomes. Impairment is essentially telling you something about if you ended up in the extreme left tail of this distribution. Our goal was to try and get some information that filled in the rest of the distribution. Just how successful was it? And as Anne said, one of the things we said in giving entities the choice, so suppose you have an existing Division A, you buy some other company and you're just going to put it completely into Division A. Maybe it fills out the product line, maybe it fills out geographically, who knows. But we would have expected in doing so that you would have had some expectations for how this revised Division A, this expanded Division A would perform. And essentially all we're asking is if you expected, say, the return on capital for the revised Division A to be above, say, 10% every year for the next 5 years once you'd brought in and got through the initial integration things, that's all we were asking for, is we expect this division to have some sales growth because we're going to expand into geography, whatever, and we expect a reasonably high return on capital, and it can be totally about this division. So it's an expectation for what you see this division to be, fully integrated. We're not asking you to peel out the contribution made by the new entity. We're letting you actually just, what is your expectation for this brand new created division? And I think if I'm getting this right, what Anne would like to know is this possible just to help fill out this distribution? So what would happen? Like, how happy are you? How close to perhaps your expectations? Because typically you do pay, you know, a premium relative to whatever the entity was trading at beforehand, and people just want to understand whether this sort of came true in a reasonable kind of way. So I don't know if that helps.
Tom, I would like to add further. Let us take two entities. One says we have integrated from day one. Other one keeps track of, say, three acquisitions separately. So the entity which combines or integrates from day one will have a benefit to offset each of those three acquisitions, positive and negative growth in one basket, right? So that way, if at all, if there was any goodwill impairment in one of the acquisition, it gets hidden in the overall scheme of things. So that will create some inconsistency between the entities, the way in which they look at the complete integration or as a separate acquisitions being carried out in future as reporting entities separately.
So you're raising an issue of comparison between yes. entities.
Yes.
And does it go so far as probably a competition issue?
No, it is nothing to do with competition. What I'm saying is an entity which combines various acquisitions together will have an advantage to carry on with their goodwill without being impaired versus another entity which keeps track of those individual entities separately. That's all I'm trying to say here.
Sure. Jawad, do you want to...
Maybe I can just briefly come in on the comparability point. And I think in developing the disclosures, at least the board recognize that using a management approach could lead to different disclosures by different entities, depending on how they obviously manage the business. Like some, like you said, might integrate it from day one, and further to Tom and Anne's point, would provide integrated information about the objectives and subsequent performance, while another entity which tracks it separately would give metrics for that individual business combination. But I think comparability, at least, and the board members on the table can correct me, but at least the way I understood it, comparability was less of a concern in this space because business combinations are all kind of one-off transactions, and the information users want is about the success of the business combination, and the board felt it was better to see it through management's eyes and how management is monitoring that and tracking the business combination along with how it's integrating it or using it in its business, rather than, for example, asking for like all entities to disclose, for example, specific metrics. And that was the basis or genesis, rather, of this management approach. So comparability, while it was considered, was not the prime driver in coming up with these disclosures. I'm not sure that helps partly answer your question.
Yeah, very much. Thank you for that, Javed.
Jan, you wanted to answer or to react to what the members have said.
I try and be brief. To the other board members that were asked about 5 minutes ago about the integrated reporting, yes, of course we have integrated results that are reviewed by the chief operating decision maker. It's called the segment reporting, and we already have that in IFRS 8. So if there is a new business that is part of something that is large enough, material enough to be reviewed by the CODM, it is already in the segment reporting. And to Tom, you've really hit the nail on the head, Tom. This is actually the key point to this whole discussion. What people would like us to do is to publish our five-year business plan. That's what people would really like to do. And if I understood your question properly, what you'd like us to do is publish our business plan for this, the whole division, which every time there's an M&A activity. And this is, I'm exaggerating here just to make the point, but that is actually the reason there is hunger from analysts and some users on this topic and on the topic of goodwill impairment and the disclosures that are required in the goodwill impairment standard. They're not interested in goodwill. They're not interested in goodwill impairment. They're interested to know what the company's expectations are for the growth of their business. And if there's a compulsory disclosure requirement in the impairment standard or in here, of course, they're going to say they want it, and they're going to say they want it, and they're going to say they want more. So just to, that is exactly where that's coming from.
And what would be the problem then from your perspective in answering this request?
Well, Bertrand, you can take that to your former boss at Vivendi and then you can see what they'd say.
I know the answer, but...
There is a legitimate point where investors want to know what management are spending their money on the M&A field. I think there's a legitimate interest there. Whether this, what is being proposed here is actually the wrong answer to the right question, so to speak. And I think we really need to sort of think about what actually is it realistic to give investors and shareholders, what information is it realistic that they have in order to actually be able to turn around to management and say, what actually have you doing with your money and what value is it generating? Those are legitimate questions. But I think what we're talking about here is not actually going to answer those questions.
Can I just ask one question?
Sorry. Rika, sorry. Please continue so that we keep on continuing the discussions in this
That's
area.
That's my question. So if you purchase one company and put in the one segment, and then how CODM monitor and track the success of that acquisition is just looking at the segment revenue. So they consider the probably 10% increase in segment revenue for that particular segment. That is the only thing they are monitoring. In that case, is it a problem for the management to say they are monitoring that target? At the same time, they also assess the success of acquisition monitoring that metrics. Is that a problem for you to explain to the investors?
Jan, you want to answer to that?
At a segment level, yes, and it's not only so. At a segment level, we will routinely track sales, costs, everything, CapEx, cash generation. We do that for every segment, whether there's an acquisition in there or not. We just don't disclose forward-looking information about our budgets and our business plans, whether there's a M&A activity in there or whether there's not. But of course, the chief operating decision maker and everybody in the business is observing this the whole time. But we don't distinguish between when there's an acquisition in there and when there's not. The acquisition will be factored into the overall expectations, and we will manage the business on a new world basis going with the company as it then is. This is the real crunch of why there's sort of opposition from folks like us to disclosing this, because that's exactly where it's heading. It's disclosing information about our budgets and business plans, which we do not think that is appropriate to disclose in a set of IFRS financial statements. That's our view, I think, but I can be corrected by other people.
Because of confidential reason, I would suspect.
I think it's dramatic overreach of what is in a set of financial statements prepared under the historical cost convention. That's what we're producing here is reporting to the shareholders and investors on what was achieved in the last financial year. What we are not doing here is producing an investment prospectus for people about whether they might like to invest. And now we appreciate it gives valuable information to people who are doing that kind of analysis, but that is not the purpose of the exercise. And I think we get in a kind of sort of mission creep thing here where we sort of, and I appreciate the ISB have people saying, yeah, we'd like to see this, but is a set of financial statements the right place for this kind of thing to be? And once you start doing it, where do you stop? Do you look at if there's a big CapEx invest? We do CapEx investment of $1 billion in a new manufacturing site. Now, do you want to know whether that's going to add value or not? It's a fair enough question, but then do you want to put that in a set of financial statements? So this is really, you know, we may be skiing a little bit off-piste here, but this is the heart of where the opposition to this, or the concerns about this. We just think it's not necessarily a wrong thing to ask, but it's the wrong place to put it in a set of audited IFRS financial statements prepared under the historic cost conditions. It just doesn't fit.
Thank you, Jan. Stephen?
Yes, I guess just to add to what Ian's saying, the users have different objectives, of course, and their objectives would include not only using information in one company's financial statements for investment in that entity, but also across their own portfolio. So we do also have a conflict where the management of a business is acting in the interest of its shareholders and its owners, and then the users are looking at a wider portfolio. So I think that also creates additional tension, particularly around the forward-looking statements.
Johan? Johan?
Yeah, was it the question to me? I don't really have anything more to add. I concur on what has been said by both Ian and others. I think also that I agree to a large extent on what Ian said in his last remark.
Okay. Richard?
Yeah, I would like to comment on Tom and Rika's comments. So Tom is entirely correct. You can have an acquisition which is rapidly integrated and therefore included in a larger CGU, that goodwill may never be impaired, because even if the acquisition fails miserably, the goodwill may not be impaired because of the sheltering of the CGU that it is incorporated in. So I think that there's an issue there, and for acquisitions which are integrated into the business, I think you've really got two choices. One, some of those acquisitions, say if it's a geographical expansion or a product expansion, yes, we can track the sales, probably gross margin, but not much below that for the product line or the geographic regions. We can probably do that for a period of time. Edges get a bit fuzzy after a while, but you can do that. But if it's neither a product line nor geographic, if it's more integrated, then it's harder to give information which is specific to that unit after it's been integrated, in which case you could look at the combined entity. But I think there would be a lot of resistance for the reasons that have been given to giving a lot of information about the combined entity and how it's meeting targets that were revised because of the acquisition. But there is an issue. There is an issue with the sheltering, definitely.
Is there any further question from board members? Or any further comments from GPF members?
Maybe Bruce, just you want to one, Bertrand, if you just ask, maybe the we probably considered this, but I think if the ISB is moving this direction, you need to line up with the FASB and other preparers as well, because certainly I can say in Switzerland we do find some companies are moving away from IFRS to the local GAAP because they don't like making these kind of disclosures. So just be, there's that element, but I think particularly if the ISB goes in this direction and the FASB is not, I think that would be highly unfortunate, and I think IFRS preparers would be very unhappy about that. But I imagine you've got that covered.
Good reminder. Thank you, Ian. Team, you're on.
Next topic, okay.
Next topic.
Excellent. So, as Craig mentioned earlier, the board is also investigating a couple of specific topics in relation to the amortization of goodwill. It's doing this to help inform its future decision on whether to reintroduce amortization of goodwill or, as per its preliminary view, to retain the impairment-only model. Feedback on these topics, along with an understanding of what the disclosure package might look like once the concerns raised by respondents to the discussion paper being considered, will help the board as it decides the subsequent accounting for goodwill. One of those topics is whether a reliable, useful life of acquired goodwill can be estimated, and whether that would provide users of financial statements with useful information. And the feedback on the discussion paper, whether a reliable estimate can be made, was more mixed than in 2004 when the board had decided to require an impairment-only model for the subsequent accounting for goodwill. The questions for GPF members on this second topic are on slide 16. And we'd like to understand from GPF members, regardless of your overall views on amortization or impairment only, whether you think it's feasible for management to estimate the useful life of goodwill and the pattern in which it diminishes on a transaction-by-transaction basis, how those estimates would be made and what information would be needed, and whether that information is readily available, and finally, what the costs of making those estimates would be. So I'd like to open the floor up to GPF members now for discussion.
If I may just make a preliminary comment, we are not discussing there, or we are not seeking your views, GPF members, on whether or not you prefer amortization of goodwill or impairment test only model, because otherwise we'll still be discussing the issue tomorrow morning. At the end of the day, there will be a 50-50 split, and we will not have progressed that much. I think there is a genuine request made by the staff to you, which is to know whether, in case the board were to decide reintroducing amortization, which the board has not yet decided, and I remind you of the fact that in the discussion paper what is proposed is to stick on impairment test. The genuine question is really, is there a possibility to determine a useful life to amortize a goodwill? So just to circumscribe the question asked by the staff, we do not discuss, or we do not you do not provide answers provide insights to the questions really asked by the staff. Thank you in advance. So Richard first.
Okay, thank you. Well, firstly, I don't think you'd find it would be a 50-50 split, but don't, so that's enough said on that. So I look back at all the acquisitions that my company has done in the last few years, and in each case, we could easily have assigned the value to the goodwill. Some cases, it was the goodwill represented unrecognized intangibles, and then there's a very specific time period, like licenses or something like that. You can do a very specific allocation of useful life to that. I can't see any issue in determining useful life. I think it can be done in all cases, even if if goodwill represents the super profit that you read about in textbooks, and it still only lasts for a short period of time. So I think you can always come up with a good estimate of useful life.
Thank you, Richard. Stephen?
I think I would echo Richard's thoughts and maybe just add a little bit to them, in that it depends on how tightly the guidance is drafted. So if we're looking at estimating useful life for synergies, improvements, maybe initiatives that will generate larger profits, then it would be relatively straightforward to be able to estimate those, as long as it's not too prescriptive. I think when we get into the area of the workforce, which is always an assumption that hasn't been valued, but that's not something that necessarily works into people's thinking on what goodwill represents from a commercial perspective. I appreciate this from the ISD's perspective and from an IFRS 3 perspective. If we are asked to estimate that, then I imagine that would be a bit more challenging for us. But it very much depends on how prescriptive
we need to be in terms of guidance on how to do this. I think there'd be a reasonable way to estimate if that guidance wasn't too tightly formed.
Thank you, Stephen. Jan?
Thanks, yeah. Leaving aside that I think the useful good life of Google is precisely zero, I would encourage you to do something simple and straightforward. I think the wording in the old standard, if I recall it well, had a kind of rebuttable assumption of 20 years or something like that. I would encourage you to consider doing something. I don't say whether 20 is the right number or not, but I would encourage you to have something like that, because this is, once we start going down this route, it's going to be hellishly difficult to get auditors on board with it. So to answer your bottom bullet, if you leave it totally open, it's going to create another minefield where sort of you have a sort of consultant's gold mine and you end up with endless discussions about that particular topic. In the end, I don't think it really matters, because whatever number we put in our sector at least, all the analysts are just going to kick it straight out. So make it 10 years, 20 years, doesn't matter too much. But just have a simple rule and something that can be operationalized relatively straightforward with some kind of sort of rebuttable assumption that gives everybody a reasonable starting point and doesn't leave every single acquisition with a long internal discussion on it.
Thank you, Ian. Aki?
Yes, my view is that there's no perfect way to make use of RIDE. It may differ from industry to industry, but at least we should be very specific on the maximum life of Google. I would say, you know, given the recent trend of, you know, advanced technology, I don't think the one generation, like 30 years, is too long. I would say 15 years, you know, half of one generation. That could be a reasonable. And plus, this 15 years coincide with the, amortization period for tax purposes as well in many regions, many countries. So 15 years, we should be very specific, at least about the maximum length. Within the maximum length of like 15 years, I think each industry, each company should have freedom of choice. That's my view. Thank you.
Thank you, Aki. Spinat?
Yes. Right. I personally believe that coming out with an amortization period for amortization of goodwill should not be difficult, based on my experience. But having said that, there would be a lot of difficulties in implementing that, especially for a physical asset. You can come out with a depreciation policy of which is more objective, whereas when it comes to goodwill, it would become subjective, and the managements would be reluctant to do something which is not comparable with competitors within the industry. So they don't want to put themselves in a disadvantageous position by going ahead with this type of aggressive policies. In addition to that, I believe the cap on amortization period would be really useful for the preparers. So I think that they should work. There should not be any difficulty in coming out with the number of years in which goodwill can be recovered. The estimation is possible.
Thank you, Srinath. Johan?
Yeah, maybe I'm repeating some of the things that have been already said, but I think, for starters, there are so many areas where companies need to do estimates and judgments, and I don't really see why this would be an area where it's not possible. I think it would be perfectly possible to do that. I also think, even if I heard you, and we should not comment on the view on whether we should go for amortization or not, but I think the questions are linked in some respect, so bear with me. But I also think that I agree that it should be a limit on how long useful life you should be able to have on goodwill, and if that would be on a reasonable level. I also think that, being maybe a little bit more practical more than theoretical, maybe I think it would also maybe improve actually the purchase price allocations done in connection with business combinations, because then you would not have the difference between goodwill, which is supposed to be some sort of residual in some respect, where there is no amortization, and other surplus values. I think it would be because my view is that normally a lot of surplus value should be allocated to other things than goodwill, but in those cases they are normally amortized over a shorter period of time. So I think that would take a little bit the edge of that sort of discussion, not having a lot of goodwill in some cases, maybe where it's convenient because you don't get the amortization cost. So I think the two questions are linked. I think it would be perfectly possible to estimate the useful life, which should not be too long, not 30 years at least, as someone said, shorter than that. And I think it would be a more practical approach than the current version. That is, maybe I can fully understand from a theoretical point of view, but which I think is not working that well in practice, honestly.
Zhang?
Okay. A cutting of goodwill, though there are many criticism of the current impairment model. Here I'm not going to repeat them here. But as we all know, business come in circle. Even though it may not be easy to determine the payback period of an acquisition, management can use its best estimate to come up with one. So this amortization period must be industry specific. For those technology companies, this period will be shorter for more traditional industries. On top of that, perhaps in a standard, we can put back rebuttal or presumption so that the goodwill can be amortized over maybe not more than 20 years. I think this would be give repairs some room to experience some adjustment for the amortization period on their own facts and the circumstance, but with a ceiling not over 20 years. So on top of this, if there are treasury events, this do then they can do impairment test. Judgment would need to be made on the amortization period, but you only do this once in the year of acquisition. I'm not doing annual impairment test, where judgment would be need be made each year. I think this would be easier to apply to provide some safeguard. The net book value would be lower than the recoverable amount. So this is my opinion.
Thank you, Zhang. Michael?
Yeah, I just want to repeat here that, I do think that with the variety of estimates and judgments and valuation techniques that are used in connection with IFRS, I personally think that we would be able to come up with an estimate for a reasonable amortization period of goodwill. I would echo as well that I think using a simplified approach to keep the range of amortization periods to something that I would say is a little tighter would be a good idea. I just also want to repeat Ian's comment that analysts in our industry would definitely kick out any kind of amortization. So it is, from their perspective and their modeling perspective, they would be very indifferent as to what period is actually used.
Thank you, Michael.
Srinath, you wanted to?
Yes. Yeah, I just wanted to add a small comment here. It's more of optics or psychological. I think management's view impairment as a M&A failure of management, whereas an amortization would be something normalized approach similar to depreciation. It is something which is accepted by wider community. So in terms of acceptance, I think amortization would be a better option rather than impairments from the point of view of management disclosures. So I, in terms of acceptability, I would see amortization would be more welcoming. I don't know what are the views of other members, but personally, I feel that is something I wanted to add.
Tim, you wanted to ask a question or make a comment?
Well, yeah, I was just going to comment on some of the comments that we've heard so far and just maybe ask a couple of follow-up questions. I mean, I think for all of those that have spoken, there seems to be quite a consensus that a reliable estimate can be made. It'll be really useful, I think, and I realise, obviously, like we're talking about disclosures, all acquisitions are different, and therefore there's probably going to be, and there's probably no perfect factor that you could use to base the estimate on, and it's probably going to be a range of different factors. But it'll be really useful for us to hear from GPF members some of the types of information that you might actually use and look to make those estimates. And then my second question, which is again, virtually all members that have spoken have talked about you can reliably estimate it, but you've also talked about having a maximum, a cap to that. I just wanted to understand a little bit more about, if you think you can reliably estimate it, why would you need a cap? I just want to try to understand a little bit more about the reasons for the cap.
Thank you, Tim. Katsuhiro, you had a comment prior to Tim's question, so you can do both. You can comment on what you initially wanted to comment on, and if you have a view on Tim's questions, please do not hesitate to answer Tim. Thank you. You're on mute, Katsuhiro. No, Katsuhiro, we don't hear you. No, we can't hear you. We'll let you try to figure out the way to proceed, and we'll hear from Jan first, then. And we'll come back to you, Katsuhiro, as soon as you have figured out the way to deal with the technical issue. Thank you.
Yeah, Tim, I think the point is, it depends on the company, but like in some years we might do sort of 10 of these kind of deals, and a lot of them are quite small. So actually not having to go through this 10 times, but having a sort of default position, whether it's 15 or 20, whatever the number is, would be helpful. I think however you do it, if you could phrase it in the same way that's in IS 16, that might be helpful. For example, you know, all motor vehicles, we amortize over 3 years. We don't sort of nickel and dime it. And I think if there's a possibility to have a sort of a general policy that the company establishes, and obviously if there's some really big ticket item, you'd have to do something different. I think that would be helpful rather than requiring every single acquisition to have a specific bespoke exercise for each one.
Johan?
Yeah, as a comment to why, in my case, I would like to have a limitation on the period. I think, honestly, I have very hard times thinking that I would come up with an estimate of a useful life longer than, let's say, 20 years. But I also think that would be good. It's more, from my side, it's also some sort of a practical view on this, that if we hypothetically would go back to the amortization model and not creating the same, let's say, issues that we have today with impairment testing, I think we need to have a limit on the useful life period, because otherwise you could say, okay, this is useful life of 50 years, and then you would sort of, that would be virtually the same to some extent as the impairment models. I think it would be more foreseeable, more practical, more easy. And as someone said, I think from an investor perspective or an analytical analyst perspective, this is disregarded anyway in many cases. So I think this is the combination in my case from a theoretical and a practical view on this, to have a limit in the useful life period.
Thank you, Johan. Srinath?
Yeah. Goodwill cannot be equated with land. So I would say goodwill has a limitation in terms of what is the time frame in which you can realize the benefits. So there has to be a time frame. So from looking at the future cash flows, anything beyond 20 years is of no use, as all of you realize. So I don't see why the same principle cannot be applied to goodwill. So I cannot see any reason for not having more than 20 years for impairing goodwill. I think 20 years is really a long time frame to impair any acquisition goodwill. Beyond 20 years would be very unreasonable.
In many cases, too long also in 20 years, because to foresee things, I think in many cases it would probably be, at least in my view, it should be shorter, but I think 20 is probably the limit.
I think just to add to that, there are various jurisdictions where national accounting standards allow maximum 20 years. I think if I vaguely remember, I've seen this in Brazil, in local accounting. I'm not sure if Murilo...
In Sweden, it's in Swedish GAAP, it's actually 5 years now, which has actually had the peculiar effect that some companies have converted to IFRS for that reason alone, but that's another topic.
Stephen?
Yes, in answer to the question, another element is, we do recognise that this is a highly judgmental area. So the calculation of goodwill is really a residual value. By the time you've valued your inventories and all of your recognised intangibles and balance, other balance sheet items, it is just what's left. And then what you do with that is to look at the goodwill value. You say, well, is that reasonable given the assumptions that I have made on things like synergies? And so, and that's kind of one of the logic checks. But I think it's helpful to have an end point, just because of the element of judgment that is inherent in the goodwill valuation itself. Just to stop people making what would be considered by a rational user an unhealthy judgment.
Thank you, Stephen. Katsuhiro, are you back?
Yes, I hope I'm back. Can you hear me?
We hear you perfectly. Loud and clear.
Great, thank you. Thank you. So let me make my initial comments in terms of the determination of the useful life of goodwill. I think I would say that will not be easy, but I believe it is feasible to reliably make an estimation. Because management reviews the investment and returns carefully when we do the business combinations always. So that kind of careful reviews includes, of course, payback periods. So that kind of period may be a good starting point to determine the useful life. And also maybe such determination may be judgmental or subjective. But it's a management estimate. And I see the management estimate used across in all in the financial statements. Actually financial statements are consist of many estimates. So I see no reason to exclude the useful like determination from such kind of estimate. And also in terms of the cap, I think it's just unhealthy to set the longer periods, and I'm not sure if benefits can be enjoyed for such long period. So regardless of 15 or 20 years, I think we should set the cap for the useful life. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further comments being by my fellow board members? Do you have the proper answer you were looking after, Tim?
No, that's been useful. I mean, I think as I said, there seems to be a consensus that a reliable estimate can be made, and the information is available for that. So.
Yeah. And I've heard also remembering setting a cap as a maximum duration. Let's put it that way. Okay. Does anyone want to add anything on this session on disclosures, goodwill, and impairment? GPF members? Or team? We have one more question. Sorry. Sorry, there is one further question, effectively. Please,
Tim. So the other topic the board is investigating is the potential effects of reintroducing amortization of goodwill on transition. So with a few respondents to the board's discussion paper concerned that if amortization is reintroduced, that could have a significant effect on entities' financial positions. So the questions for GPF members on this topic are on slide 19. We'd like to understand from GPF members, if the board were to reintroduce amortization and require entities to derecognise large amounts of historic goodwill on transition, what the potential effects of, for example, some entities having negative equity or negative future earnings as a result could be on their ability to remain listed, pay dividends, meet loan covenants, and so on. So I'd like to open the floor up for discussion amongst the GPF members.
Jan?
I'm not aware of any. I think in our case, a lot of these are to do with the statutory financial statements of the holding company and not the IFRS consolidated statements. Now, that might be different for a few other folks, but I wouldn't think of many. In my experience, a lot of people like the rating agencies and banks just put a red line through the goodwill number anyway. And if anyone knows a bank that's prepared to lend us money on the basis of goodwill as collateral, I think our treasury team would very much like to hear from them. So, but I think it may be some issue in other places, but not that I'm aware of.
Thank you, Ian. Stephen?
Yes, thank you. I agree with Ian in terms of covenants. So most covenants that I come across and work with are based on EBITDA, which of course excludes amortization, and would also have a gap changes clause in there, so that if there is a change to accounting standards, that would be in a sensible way. And also agree, so in the UK, the ability to pay dividends is company specific, and obviously goodwill is arising at group level. But that does lead on to a potential segue. There's very little guidance around on impairment of investment in subsidiary companies. And that is important to an individual company that then will be looking to pay a dividend. And what does happen at the moment, in my experience, is that we look at standards like the goodwill impairment, and we use the principles of that in assessing investment impairment. And therefore, I think it would be worthwhile the board having some thought as to whether there would be some unintended consequences of reintroducing amortization, and maybe clarifying the boundary to that as being very much within the goodwill area.
and not with a read across into investment carrying values.
Michael?
Yeah, number one, I really just want to say that I like the idea of a transition method that would permit an entity to basically write off their goodwill to equity. I think there's a lot of merit to that. I wouldn't necessarily even restrict it to just what you think you should have left. I would encourage the board to consider a transition method where if a company chooses, they could go ahead and eliminate their entire goodwill balance against equity. To Ian's point, there's a lot of focus on tangible equity, and I think covenants and whatnot take that into account. And I would also just highlight here that I think once the board makes its decision, that again, the various jurisdictions that endorse and otherwise put IFRS into play will need to consider these, I would just say, secondary effects related to the standard. But I definitely believe that this is the right way to think about this for transition.
Thank you, Michael. Srinath?
Yeah, there could be regulatory impact on dividend distribution if you were retained earnings gets negative or reduced drastically. That is one thing I can foresee, but this is more of educating the local regulators that this is nothing to do with cash, distributable cash. It is more to do with an accounting treatment. And definitely as part of transition, I would expect the goodwill impairment to go directly in equity rather than going through P&L, which is the norm now. Thirdly, I'm sure there would be historical loan agreements with debt equity ratio mentioned in that. That is something which we need to renegotiate or educate our bankers rather than anything to do with accounting. Thank you.
Thank you, Srinath. Johan?
Yeah, more or less the same. I think dividend regulations are normally based on the legal entity, the parent company, so it would probably not be an issue. And I think that when it comes to loan covenants, I guess it would be a renegotiation. It would be the same for all companies from a standard perspective. So I think I don't think that would be an issue, even though there would possibly be a need for renegotiation of agreements. But I think I don't think this transition would be an issue if that would be the route. I think that would be perfectly doable, honestly.
Richard?
So I'm just like I say, agreed with the comments that have gone before. No significant issues really with the change.
Aki?
Assuming the retroactive adjustments should be made to equity account, on top of the power to pay dividend and covenant matter, I would also point out the impact to credit ratings of the entity. So that has to be a big issue as well, and a certain one-time relief should be considered if we try to enforce the amortization. This is something we have to carefully address. Thank you.
Thank you, Aki. Jan, you wanted to come back?
Very briefly, but just on the dividend question, a company shouldn't be paying dividends using goodwill as a basis anyway, should they? So actually, if writing off the goodwill stops a company paying dividends, isn't that a good thing?
It's a good thing.
Tim, do you have all you wanted to...
Yes. Yeah. No. That's useful. I mean, it generally sounds like most members think it's that there aren't significant issues. There are things that need to be addressed, and there may be some renegotiations of some debt agreements or loan covenants. but generally speaking, members don't think there are significant issues, although there are some different opinions within the group.
We'll have to be, I don't know how it's feasible, but probably we will have to be careful depending on the jurisdictions. There may be jurisdictions whereby it could be a critical issue, and others where, of course, it's not an issue, as Jan mentioned, and some other BDF members mentioned, effectively, when dividends are based on, or income taxes are based on statutory accounts, of course, it's not that problem, but there might be other jurisdictions whereby, if they have IFRS statutory financial statements, for instance. We maybe have to double check that.
Yeah, and that's something that we're doing. We are reaching out further to try to gather information about different jurisdictions around the globe, because as you say, some jurisdictions could be impacted by it.
Thank you. Any further comments or questions from GPF members or board members? We have kept the timing for the first session. Congratulations to all. And let's do a short break and let's reconvene at 5 to 1. So in a bit more than 15 minutes time.
Thank you.
Thanks to all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jawad, team, and Craig.